Broadcasting from deep within the second realm, you are listening to agoristradio.com.
Hello, this is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. Agoristradio.com is sponsored by MetroPie.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Cypherpunk. This is Hero White, and today we have a special guest who has returned to be with us again, Mids, and he is going to give us a whole lot of information about the Bitcoin API, how we can use this thing to program, tie into it for doing exchanges, automated shopping carts, market systems, whatever you need to integrate Bitcoin into our systems. Mids, are you there?
Hey, Hero, this is Mids.
Hey, yeah, man. Thanks a lot for coming back on the show. I've been looking forward to talking about this API, as we just covered a few days ago, the Loom API. So why don't you go ahead and tell us about this, an introduction to the API, and then we'll just head off from there.
Sure. Let's get my notes here. So the Bitcoin client itself has a built-on JSON RPC API, which you can call from pretty much every programming language out there. On the Bitcoin wiki, there's an overview of implementations for Python, Ruby, PHP, C#, Java, I mean, all the popular ones. And on top of that, there are many, many wrappers written in those specific languages. Mm-hmm. This, of course, requires you to have a running Bitcoin client somewhere which you can connect to. So if you have a shared web host where you run your web shop or your application, you might not be able to run it locally. And you would need to set up a remote connection to your own machine, or maybe on an Amazon EC2 instance somewhere. So this is really the native support by Bitcoin itself for APIs.
Let me ask a couple of things here, because I know these are some things going through some of the listeners' minds. First off, most people are familiar with the Bitcoin GUI, the graphical user interface. If you're running the graphical user interface, you can't access this this JSON interface. Is that correct? You need to be running the command line interface version of Bitcoin?
There are two options. If you add the minus server command line argument to the Bitcoin client executable, then it will both run the API and also run the client.
Okay.
You can also do it headless and just run the Bitcoin D program, and then it only runs the API.
What did you say, Atlas?
Headless, without user interface.
Right, sorry. Okay, now also to get the structure of how this is set up, it appears that the API is an interface to your local running client. This is not an API that's going to connect to any other Bitcoin server and like through the IRC system or do any type of communications. This is only an API for your local running Bitcoin system, correct?
Right. You'll be running it fully peer-to-peer. So you don't depend on any external servers to connect to, like a PayPal API or what Pecunix X or something like that.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, great. As an alternative, there are also some services like mybitcoin.com, and they also offer a shopping cart interface. The popular exchange, the trade Bitcoin trade site, mountgox.com, also has a trade API, which also allows you to send Bitcoins. So
I saw that. I have that listed here. Let's go over those a little bit later in the show, because there's some specific things I'd like to talk about that you can do with those that I have some nice features with that. Can you tell us what can you do with the API or can you not do that's different from the graphical user interface?
As far as I know, you can do everything that you can with the API. I mean, there might be some. Maybe you cannot not delete a local account or something like that. But other than that, I believe you can. I mean, all the settings are out there, so there should be a 100% coverage.
Okay. I'm just going to go – the API commands here are actually kind of interesting. I'm not going to read the description, but I'm going to read the command because there's not that many of them. This comes from the original Bitcoin client API calls list. And does that mean anything when it says original Bitcoin client? Why does it say original?
This is the reference implementation. I mean, there are some more clients being worked on. The Bitcoin Java client, which was a Google 20% time project with some guy, and those clients, they don't have this this interface, or they might have a different interface. But this is the interface by the client that you would download from bitcoin.org.
Okay, great. Well, I'm going to go through this list real quick because I think it's interesting. Here's the different commands: backup wallet, get account address. Get address by account, get balance, get block by count, get block count, get block number, get connection count, get difficulty, get generate, get hash, aspersic, I'm not reading that correctly, get info, get new address, get received by account, get received by address, get transaction, get work, help, list accounts, list received by account, list received by address, list transactions, move from account to account and amount, send from, send to address, set account, set, generate, stop, and validate address. That's a Bitcoin address. So there's some nice little things in there.
Yeah, I think you can classify them in three groups. I mean, there's some purely informational ones and configuration, like disable the mining or enable it. That's the set generate option. And also get some information about your current client operations. Then there are some mining specific ones, like get work and get difficulty count, I think. And the other ones are for, sending, receiving payments and verifying those.
Okay.
What's interesting, I think, if you look at this list, I mean, this has been growing and a new, I think this, there hasn't been a very good design for these comments. So some new ones were added and some do an overlap a little bit and some might be deprecated. So I would hope that they will clean this up and create maybe create a version 2 of the interface, because this is slowly starting to turn into a mess. Okay. But on the other hand, it's very powerful at the moment.
Yeah. Okay. Has there been anything that you have done that you have found interesting or cool, particularly in your case?
Well, you can with the Bitcoin Daemon. You can also use it as a client. So if you just run Bitcoin D and space and then one of these command names, then you can just execute them from your command line. And that's great to experiment with.
Okay, so this API you can call through the command line or through the JSON interface.
Yeah, okay. Very useful for debugging.
Okay, that's pretty interesting.
And also the backup wallet command I use scheduled to copy my wallet file, PGP encrypted, and copy it to a remote location for safekeeping.
Right. I think, did we mention that on a previous show, something about that could be an interesting service that someone could provide out there for offering a backup service, of course, client-side encrypted backup, of people's wallets? So.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you just use PGP and encrypt it to yourself, then you can just send it off somewhere else and have them store it for you.
Yeah.
I mean, you can also use Dropbox for this or some other service.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, right. Now, a couple little things I want to bring up that I ran across. There's an article in here on the wiki that talks about paper money, proper money handling with the JSON RPC. And they give examples in Bash, C, Perl, PHP, Python, and the like. Just a caveat emptor about the way that some of these languages can interpret integers. So it gives recommendations because it's very important to there's a huge difference between 0.09 and 0.099999.
Yeah. Unfortunately, due to the way that the bitcoins are serialized in the JSON protocol, some clients might interpret them as a floating point. And using floating points for money is a big anti-pattern. So you need to do some fixes on your client to work around this or to prevent it from being slightly misrepresented. So I think I still hope that they will fix the API and just use a string for the amount or just use an integer instead of this. This is just confusing.
Oh,
it will lead to many rounding errors.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Great.
So, as a tip: if you create your own currency, just don't use floating points, please.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, it was really nice when we went over the Loom API the other day. Is we use the shopping cart example, and I think that it's nice to use that as an example. It's quite elementary when you consider about all of the amazing cool things that you can do. And a shopping cart interface, you know, when you go to a bank or a currency exchange, you know, you don't get a shopping cart. You know, you more think of a shopping cart as something for Amazon or at a grocery store. So when people talk about doing Bitcoin shopping carts, it sounds just too basic when what you can do with this is use it as a front end for your own personal or business exchanging service, or to run, there's these sort of like currency stock market systems out there, trading systems. And if you're running one of these systems internally, you're going to have your own house accounts that people get credited, but you're going to have your own external Bitcoin account that people will pay into, and the total balance of all bitcoins on credit in your own internal house accounts will add up on a system to the same amount that are actually being held in the operator's Bitcoin purses. So when you when people transfer bitcoins into the MTGOX system, and then there's exchanges happening around, these guys are using their own internal system for doing that. So you're going to need an exchange or bail-in or whatever you want to call it system. And that basically is just another fancy shopping cart. So can we go real quickly through what a programmer who is setting up any type of system, He's setting up an online casino. Let's just use that. And he needs to accept money from a Bitcoin user and then validate the money and then credit that user's account and then send the money back out when that user wants to do an out exchange. Can we get a little run through on how a programmer would do that?
Sure, but first, I mean, this pattern that you've been describing, I mean, the e-wallet pattern, it's very common, and you see it with many of the Bitcoin merchants. They use it. I mean, it's a bit more complex to implement, but it matches quite well with the way the client works, and also when you transfer Bitcoins, you have to wait a couple minutes, or maybe depending on your security, a bit longer to get these confirmations. Mm-hmm. And this way, you can pre-fund your accounts and have some money ready instead of having to wait when you actually want to make a currency exchange, for example. Advantage of this is that you have a way to store your Bitcoin without having a client. So you can just, if you trust mountgox.com, you can just store your Bitcoins there. You don't need to run a local client.
Right.
And you can also use it for money laundering purposes or money washing or whatever you want to call it. I mean, all the transactions are publicly accounted in the distributed Bitcoin database. So using such a site might be a good middleman to store and obfuscate a paper trail.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, there's some ideas that some people have been throwing around for doing some like Bitcoin mix master type mixing, you know, just to, you know, throw the tracking off when people are trying to track a transaction happening between the two. So, well, let's go ahead and go through this. How would you implement this yourself in your little shopping client for your casino?
So I'm looking at the comment list. I mean, the preferred way is, I mean, you need to have a unique Bitcoin address for every payment that you want to receive, because only that way you know which account to credit internally in your bookkeeping system or in your database. I mean, you cannot specify a transaction number with the Bitcoin payments. I mean, you might do something funky with a specific number or do some time correlation, but that just gets too complex.
Okay. Well, this is interesting because in the Loom system, if you're
should be generated,
yeah, I'm sorry, we had a connection issue. In the Loom system, if you're a merchant and you want to be the person who creates that payment location, you have to do the same thing. You have to create a separate location for them to pay to. Now, in the Bitcoin system, how long does it take to create a new payment address? That's instantaneous, correct? So the last thing I was asking was the connection, the payment address. You were saying it needs to be unique for every customer who's sending in, or it needs to be unique per transaction, not just per customer. Is that correct?
Well, you can make it unique per customer, but then you cannot differentiate between payments. So I mean, the recommended is to make it unique per transaction.
Okay,
and then you can stop monitoring it afterwards.
And when you created this new payment ID, that's an instantaneous, instantaneous process. You don't need to stock up on these ahead of time, correct?
Right. I mean, if you run a client locally and you can just immediately connect to it, then you can just run it real time.
Okay.
But the client also allows you to, if you use the get account address command, then you can tag it with like a account name or a username or the internal user ID that you have for your casino visitor. And that way you don't need to keep track of all the addresses that were initiated. You can just use it as an alias. So that's also the recommended way to do it.
Oh, okay.
So first you would run a get account address and then the user ID, for example, and then it gives you the the current account Bitcoin address that the user can use. So you would display this in your user interface. And afterwards, well, for every screen refresh, or maybe you want to cache this or do it once in a while, you can call the get balance command for the, again, with the account name, so the user ID internally from your system, and then tells you the total balance.
Okay.
If you're interested in the specific transactions, then you can use one of the other commands to get a breakdown and some more information, like how many confirmations there were, so you know how secure it was. And you can set a threshold there as well, so okay. You won't see any fresh ones, just the ones that are more secure.
I do have a few questions on that. But, you know, I'm having a little bit of a technical issue here. We need to take just a few moments break, and then we'll be right back.
All right.
Thank you. So you send this, you give this, this user comes in, and they say, I want to deposit 500 bitcoins into my online poker account. At your little new poker company that's taking over the poker industry now that all the .coms have been shut down, and you're running in the I2P or .onion address, and you're only taking Bitcoin, so you got these guys coming to you, and they're depositing 500 Bitcoins, and you say, okay, I'll take your 500 Bitcoins. Here is your custom payment address. Please make payment to this address. That user then goes and he selects that address location and goes into his Bitcoin client and initiates a payment, correct?
Right, exactly.
Okay. Now, when he initiates that payment, what happens next? Does he come tell you, okay, I made the payment, or show you anything, or do you just sit there and keep checking that until you see that something has arrived at that location?
Well, I mean, there are different ways to handle this, and this depends on the risk, the height of the payment, and also what user experience you want to give them. Mm-hmm. So maybe you want to do a, if you do the get balance check with and specify that you're not interested in only seeing many confirmations, maybe you can instantly see, or maybe in a couple minutes you will see that the account balance has been increased, and you can already start let them play, and you would take the risk in case it was a fraudulent payment or something went wrong, or you say, well, you wait 10 minutes or longer, or till you have seen two or three confirmations before you credit them with poker chips.
Okay.
So that's a business decision that you have to make. And I think, there might be some best practices here which evolve over time, and you need to reevaluate this and maybe discuss this on the forums, what works best for your situation.
Right. I know that in some operations that I've been involved with, there have been times when a very highly trusted customer would try to place an order with a credit card that set off all the bells and whistles on the anti-fraud system for all kinds of reasons. But we knew that this was a legitimate customer, and that it was just because he was using a proxy server and that he was using a virtual credit card that he had gotten from Unlink or some other provider. And so it was just throwing it off, and we would accept the payment. Whereas if it was someone else, we'd tell them, no, we're going to wait until we have a hard payment. Like, you know, you can mail in cash or pay a different way. So if it's a known customer, you probably can have them flagged as instantaneous clearing for payments that are coming through for, like you said, to give a better user experience. But, you know, we covered this a little bit in some other shows, but not much. I think that we should give an explanation to people as to why, if the Bitcoin has been paid to this account, you see it, how can you explain how come that could possibly be a fraud, but somebody could be gaming you Why isn't an instantaneous finality of settlement is not instantaneous?
Well, this is because it's a distributed peer-to-peer system. So the way Bitcoin works, like on average, every 10 minutes, a new block of Bitcoins is discovered, and it creates a chain of coins based on all the previous ones, way back to the initial originating or the genesis block for Bitcoin. So every client that fulfills this crypto challenge and comes up with a new block, this block that he creates includes all the open transactions and the hash of the previous block. So if you would have a way to cheat that or something like that, then you could publish this, and there might be a split. There might be a split in the coin in the hash tree that's created.
Right. So someone that was being really nasty could possibly do sort of like a double spend.
To be honest, I wouldn't really know how to do this. I mean, uh-huh. It's the thing is, if there's a new block generated with a higher complexity, then that one is chosen by all the clients. So it will get more and more difficult to cheat. So even if you somehow manage to create a fake spend or double spend it with a very easy answer, then it just will take a couple minutes before another client will just overrule you. So in the end, you will be caught, and your chain that you create will just be invalid.
Okay. Now, this brings up an interesting thought. If you have, let's say you had 500 Bitcoins that you were going to throw into the poker system, and you wanted to try to do this type of a double spend thing, if you threw 500 Bitcoins into the system, you wouldn't be able to do a double spend on coins that were already generated. You only be able to do that on ones that were newly minted that you were trying to game the system. Is that correct?
Well, and as I understand it, you would need also to break this crypto hash somehow and find something. I mean, it's the way this crypto challenge is done. I mean, it's easy to verify it and very hard to generate it. That's where the Bitcoin strengths come from. So I mean, in all fairness, I don't know enough about the technical details of this to really outline how you will do such an attack.
Yeah, but, that's fine. Okay, well, let's just say for practical purposes, how long of a time or how many signatures on this need to take place before a person knows this is rock solid cash?
Well, I know the ClearCoin... the ClearCoin service, which is by one of the Bitcoin lead developers, I think he uses 6 confirmations for his services or something like that. So that should be like that would take an hour, but for average sites, I think 1 or 2 or 3 might be enough, and you might also depend it on the amount that was paid.
What? Oh, you mean.
Right, with confirmations.
Oh, and confirmations. Okay, yeah.
And with poker, you can just allow them to play and only verify this when they try to cash out. So you can just let them go and just have fun with it. Of course, you can cheat it if you cooperate with other poker players. But I think that would be a very good way to give a good user experience on a poker site and still be safe.
That's nice because you're not having any type of a hard asset that's being sent out that you could lose out on if it was a scam, you know, unless you took that guy's money and you threw it in the pool and you used that as part of a hard payout to someone else. But I guess you could just flag it as something for him to play around with while he's in there. Okay, well, that's pretty interesting. Go ahead and throw in the chat if you can that what was the name of the link you just said for checking? Real coin or what did you say?
Oh, ClearCoin. That's one of the services from.
It's just a verification thing that you can use.
It's an escrow service. I mean, it's just a third-party escrow service, but I just know what business practice they use, or this guy has published it in the past.
Okay, what about this blockexplorer.com? Is that pretty much a similar thing to what you were just describing?
No. I mean, ClearCoin is just a service if you want to do some physical shipment and you want to be able to revoke it if the shipment is not made, or if your other party doesn't deliver. So it's like escrow.com or whatever sites you have for PayPal payments.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, I hadn't seen that one. Yeah, well, there's new stuff popping up all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. So let's just say that you do a couple of confirmation. You have your policy and your threat model and your customers and your experience, and you, bam. Okay, that payment is there, and then at that moment, you want to do you want to sweep that out and move into a master account at that point?
Yeah, that's best practice to have the Bitcoin client auditing reflect your own state. So you would move it out of the account alias in the Bitcoin system and just move it to your system account, or maybe to a Visa account, or to some other holding one. So that way your customer support can always track back what happened, and you're more robust for also when doing backups and stuff like that.
Okay, great. Okay, so then at that point you have a clear transaction and the customer has their 500 poker chips. Now, let's say they play the house and they get some good hands and they win 1,000. They get their balance up to their winnings and their whatever you call it's on the table. They have 1,000 bitcoins and they want to out exchange this back out. At that point,
right,
you tell them to give you a payment address. Is that correct?
Yeah, you can do that. But I think another good practice would be request a payment to request their Bitcoin address or one of them when they sign up or when they deposit their money, just in case, so you can always refund them, or you can just fixate it. So if somebody steals their account, then they would be able to cash out to another address. Might be a fraud prevention that you want to take.
Wait, what would be a fraud prevention practice?
Well, just with I think it's also with some other services. So they don't allow you to change your credit card number once you enter it into the system.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So they could pay you, and then they just need to make sure that when they create that account and do that initial transfer in, that they register a payout address. And of course, if they're doing poker stuff, they probably should use create an alternate payment ID if they can.
Right.
What they actually,
and it's just, yeah. just be sure to already have it on file beforehand. I mean, it also gives a nicer user experience when they want to when they win the 1,000 Bitcoin and want to cash out instantly.
Okay.
So at the time you would use the send from command and specify the address and the internal account where it comes from and the target address and the amount, and then it would make the payment and it should end up in their wallet fairly instantly.
Yeah, you know what's nice about that is that if you're running this local client and you're just communicating with, well, you could local and remote it, whatever, wherever you have it. The point is that your, excuse me, your system, your code system, is communicating with some basic commands to the Bitcoin client, and the Bitcoin client is taking care of all the crypto, all of the signing, all of the transfers, and the connection to the other person and the like. So it's a nicely abstracted to be done that way. Now, on some of these systems, especially lately, we've been doing a lot of talk about the certificate authorities and how certs can be checked and the like. Do you know how the Bitcoin system is communicating between you and another person so that a man in the middle or some other type of attack can be done? Or is it when you actually are working inside of your own local wallet, when someone gives you their ID, at that moment you do a digital signature of a transfer of the coin to them with through cryptography, and then you just transfer that packet over? Is that how it works?
Right, I believe it uses one of the encrypted curve signing libraries, EHDSA or something like that, for all the payments and to sign everything. And communication to the JSON API can also be SSL encrypted, and you can hard code a certificate or something like that. So that way you can prevent a man in the middle attack if you run your client, your website on a separate machine than where you run your Bitcoin client.
Yeah, I was just thinking about an attack that could be done on the Bitcoin network and infrastructure as a whole, where someone may try to wedge themselves in and try to do something. But if you're talking about end-to-end encryption and cryptographically signed transfers of your Bitcoin asset, so to speak, your coins, to this other person, then there's the only type of man in the middle that you could have would just be sort of, well, it wouldn't be a man in the middle, it would be a denial of service. Either they'd block the communications from taking place, and if they didn't, then that piece of data would get across and transfer of ownership would not, well, just like digital signatures, it's going to have the source and who you're signing it over to, and you're not going to be able to forge that, at least from my bird's eye view of how I'm seeing some of the way that the system works, because I'm not very versed in what's going on deep under the hood.
Yeah, you need to, I mean, to counterfeit something, you would need to break the signing algorithm, and that's just but that's pretty tough at the moment. But I do think that most of the protocol is just binary unencrypted, so it doesn't have an additional crypto layer on top of it. I might be incorrect there, but I don't think it has TLS or SSL layer on top of it. So there might be some information leaking out of it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there can be. There may be information leaking, but that would be a different problem than one where someone would be literally messing with transactions that are happening. So that's
exactly.
It's kind of nice. Now, when we're talking about these transactions going back and forth, all of this is happening at quite a low bandwidth. Isn't that correct? So if you were running a Bitcoin client behind Tor or I2P, and you had a latency because of your multiple hops or other dark nets, you're not really going to suffer too much with this if you would even be able to tell at all. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, I run my own client over Tor. Uh-huh. And that works fine. I mean, with the 10 minutes between new blocks that are generated, well, maybe it takes two seconds additional latency, but you don't really care about that on that scale.
Yeah.
So just it works. I haven't noticed any drawbacks with running it over Tor for latency.
Well, that's great. Super. You know, we last show we talked about some of the infrastructure. The communications system that is happening right now, isn't that happening over – is that still happening over IRC?
No. Well, it uses IRC it for bootstrapping, or that's one of the bootstrapping strategies. I think it also has some hard-coded client IPs, because with the P2P network, once you first run it, you need to know – which clients to connect to initially, And once you're connected to the network, you can learn about new clients through the protocol itself. But it has a couple strategies to learn these initial nodes. So yeah, I think there's a couple are hard-coded in them, and it uses an IRC channel somewhere to learn about others. But the actual message is just a TCP, so it doesn't go to a central service or anything like that. And you can disable the IRC bootstrapping if you want.
Oh, okay. And excuse me. Can you throw in, is there a known host type thing that you can throw into Bootstrap with IPs that you're already aware of?
Yeah, exactly. And also on the wiki, there's a list of the some trusted IPs from the developers and things like that. But you only need one to start with, and then it just learns about other ones.
That would be nice if you were running the, excuse me, that would be nice if you're running this inside of your own darknet with I2P or Tor, and you're just connecting to the nodes within the darknet. But we're talking about bootstrapping. It doesn't actually have the ability to limit who it's connecting to. I guess you could use firewall rules and the like. Have you actually done anything with Wireshark or EtherApe or anything or TCP dump to see what kind of P2P connections are flying out all over the place? I know when you do that with Skype, you can see, 50, 60, 100 connections flying out at any time.
Well, the advantage is it's open source, so you can just look at the source code if you want to know how the protocol works and insert some logging. You don't need to break this with Wireshark or anything. No. I mean, you can if you want.
No, I wasn't referring to that. What I'm referring to is that with Skype, for example, if you load up EtherApe, it's a nice visual packet, a sniffer. You can see each node has a little circle on the screen, and you can see that, like, for example, Skype many times can have 50 or 100 connections to 100 different machines at the same time. I was wondering if you saw with Bitcoin, if you saw, like, okay, there's a little connection here, 1, 2, 3, 4, or is it connected to 50 and 100 machines at the same time?
Well, I haven't tried it with one of those sniffers, but my Bitcoin client just tells me how many connections it has.
Okay.
And most of the time it's about 10. But if you want, you can also restrict it and only have it connect to a single node, and then it won't connect to any other ones.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, you can.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. So if you knew one that was running at an I2P address or an Onion address and you're running Tor, then you could just plug it into there, and then you're just pretty much off the grid from connecting to the other.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Okay. And also, if you would run a trusted wallet somewhere on a server, you can just have it connect to a single one or to just a couple nodes that you also trust to prevent your host from being discovered. I mean, okay. It's a bit security by obscurity, but it might work out for you.
Okay, great. Do you know if it has the protocol that it's using, what kind of support it has for using outgoing proxies or socks or proxy outgoing connections, or does it need to have an open port on your firewall?
No, it supports SOCKS 4 proxies.
Okay.
And by default, you can just use your Tor proxy to connect out. You won't be able to get any incoming connections if you run this, unless you specifically open up. A Tor or Onion address on your client or something like that. But you don't.
Go ahead.
You don't really need to do this if you run Tor. I mean, you can just run it as an initiating client, and it works. At least it works fine for me. I didn't have the urge to open up my client and publish my Tor address and stuff like that.
Right, and you can, running through Tor like this, with no incoming connections, you still can receive payments, and it works all the same.
Sure. Yeah. Great. It's works fine. I mean, your payments end up in the distributed database, so
right.
You'll learn that way from them.
Right. Okay.
But if you want to accept incoming connections, I think the port is fixed. It's something like, I'm not sure, I think it's 8,333. Unfortunately, it cannot be changed. So it's hard-coded in the clients at the moment.
Port redirection and firewall rules and stuff like that to SSH port forwarding and the like to
you can do that. Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. Over here, I wanted to go over this lazy API on the Bitcoin Wiki. It says, for the incredibly lazy or incompetent web developer, I present the lazy man's Bitcoin API copied from a forum post. And it says, the problem, lazy web designer wants to use Bitcoins without dealing with installing Bitcoin on a server, installing a shopping cart interface, or using ugly merchant services with callbacks. Solution for sending Bitcoins, use the MTGOX API. So basically, you go to MTGOX and create an account there with a receiving address, and you give this information out to the customer, and they make the payment, and the payment actually goes to your it seems like it goes to your MTGOX account. So it's sort of like a proxy payment acceptance method. And you mentioned another service that does something similar to this, where you have your account there and you don't even have your own wallet.
Right, with the mybitcoin.com service. But there you need to have a callback support to be notified if a payment arrives. I think it's an interesting concept, the lazy API, and use the public block explorer to verify if a payment is made. I think it's just a side effect of a bit too difficult JSON RPC API that they provide for the clients, and you need to run this wallet to run it, to accept it. Or if you use this one of the third-party services, they all have poor APIs and they might be a bit difficult to use. So I think there is some room for a better third-party service to accept payments, and with a better user interface and a better API development experience. On the Bitcoin forums, there was a proposal about just mirroring the PayPal API and have it support Bitcoin. So that way you could, without a lot of modifications, just have about any shopping carts client or anything that has a PayPal API, you could just slightly modify it and talk to a Bitcoin service for this. So I think there should be some room to improve this and maybe start developing your own service and go from there.
Right. Okay, great. Let's see. On the main Bitcoin website, every time I go back to this wiki/trade page, there's more things. I'm going to throw this in the chat channel. Hey, and for the listeners, feel free to join us inside of the Agorist Radio IRC channel on the agora.anarplex.net IRC server. The information is on the website. We post links from the show in there, and sometimes there's interesting comments and conversations going on. Any of these services that you've seen out there that you find quite fascinating, interesting, or funny right now?
Oh, wow. I just looked at this page. I haven't looked at it for a couple weeks, and it's huge indeed.
Yeah.
I think the currency exchanges are interesting, and especially the variety that they offer.
Here's under gambling sites. There's a site here called Bitcoin Darts, a simple dart game.
Yeah, I think I tried it once. It's not fun.
Yeah, it's not fun. It's funny, but it's not fun. You know, last week there were several casino companies, gambling companies out there, and quite big ones, doing billions of dollars of business, who had their accounts frozen, money seized, their domains taken down, arrests were made, everything just shut down by the Department of Homeland Security, saving the children from gambling addictions. And there was another article posted on the Time Magazine online website that was the first article that I've seen outside of the cypherpunk type community and in the general mainstream press that actually addressed the issues that the potential issues coming up soon with Bitcoin in terms of tracking and shutting it down and seizing the Bitcoin assets and all these old tactics that they normally use, the banksters, in order to crush their competitors. And a lot of those systems and methods aren't going to work in this new cryptocurrency with Bitcoin and how it's set up. Now, there are some points that they can try to attack, like doing denial of service on all known introductory points and places where people are exchanging. But all that's going to do is then drive the information protocol, the exchange protocol that Bitcoin is using, deeper underground into areas of communication where they can't even figure out, you know, who's communicating with who.
It's an arms race, and I mean, if you can see at the current exchange charts, I mean, the price of Bitcoin has increased, so I don't think many people are worried about it for the moment.
No,
and instead, it's a lot of influx of new users, and also, well, speculation of it. I think the current price might be a bit too high. Then again, it's the market that decides. So
right.
I'm sure it will drop down in the next couple of weeks. And then when there's a new big media post, it will spike up again. It just goes up and down like this, but steadily increasing. So that's a good investment opportunity.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, I'm not ready to do some investment and try to flip my Bitcoin wallet anytime soon. Not because I don't think that I really am not interested in speculation. I'm more interested in what's going on here and how solid is it and what can be done to avoid disruptions of the service ahead of time with planning and trying to foresee some of the attacks that are going to be coming down on it ahead of time. But I know that a lot of people are talking about that. And the best way to plug up all those potential holes is for, you know, for some government to start, you know, hanging Bitcoin users by the neck. And, you know, when that stuff starts happening, then the developers really get fire under their pants. But we're closing up on our time here on the show. But you had mentioned you had a few Bitcoin rumors and myths and little trivia that was interesting you wanted to throw out here.
Sure. I mean, I think the biggest one is the lead developer, Satoshi. Mm-hmm. He has a Japanese-sounding name, and I think he mentioned that he's from Japan, but nobody believes that. But his whereabouts and his true identity is unknown. So as a that always interests me, such mysteries. And there's speculation that he's an academic type from the UK, maybe, and he just disappears now that Bitcoin is getting more popular.
Uh-huh.
Probably, who knows what when he comes back or if he is found and prosecuted, if so. But I think it's an interesting strategy to keep anonymous or pseudonymous, and it's always good food for more speculations and complot theories.
Is he in contact at this moment?
Only to a few select developers, I think.
Wow.
It's been months since he made any public comments, and I think he just disappeared from the scene.
Yeah. It doesn't sound like he has the megalomaniac personality like Julian Assange to.
No, well, maybe it's the same guy. It has been speculated that it's Julian being behind this guy. I don't think so, but who knows? Maybe it's you.
No, I'm not Satoshi. My name is Hiro.
Hiro. All right. Right.
Yeah.
You're Japanese as well, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. There
any other little Bitcoin interesting trivia?
Well, some small ones, like this electrical engineer, Art Forts, and he's creating prefabricated Bitcoin-specific mining chipsets, and I think he's experimenting with submerging them into dry ice for higher performance. And there's a lot of people doing all these crazy things on the Bitcoin mining platform.
Wait a second. Explain, what is he doing? What's his purpose? What's he trying to do to speed up Bitcoin generation mining operations?
Yeah, so he creates specific hardware for it. So he fabricates his own hardware and his own chipsets for this, and also to allow them to get a higher throughput or to overclock them higher. He submerges them into dry ice.
Something else. Has he had any luck, or is?
I'm sure he owns a lot of bitcoins.
Oh man, that's quite humorous. For a lot of listeners out there, one of the fascinating things that came out when people started mining with the bitcoins was that the GPUs, the graphic processing units on a lot of video cards like the NVIDIA, another one, sometimes they have 1, 2, 3, 4 or so GPUs on these cards that people would buy, would have processing power significantly more than a computer. And they wrote libraries so that you could do your Bitcoin mining using the GPU, the graphic chips, rather than your regular CPU. Mids, do you have any idea on the speed gain that a lot of users would get over their regular CPU going with a dual GPU card?
Oh, if you use a regular CPU, it will take years before you create your own Bitcoin. And I think with GPUs, you can still create them every other day or something like that.
Okay, the only GPU mining the only mining going on really right now is only happening with these GPUs. Is that correct then?
Exactly. It makes no sense to do a CPU mining. Even if you have a botnet with 1,000 computers, it's just not worth it.
Wow.
But with the GPU power, I wouldn't be surprised if the combined, computer power that's thrown onto Bitcoin. I mean, of course, it's difficult to compare, but I think I wouldn't be surprised if it's more than Folding at Home or CT at Home or Distributed Net or any of the other networks. I think it has a lot of power behind it.
Yeah, if it's not, it seems like it would be. Well, especially if you have a financial incentive here for people to get these GPUs and do their thing, whereas a lot of the at home and that SETI stuff was just people running it with their screensavers just because it was cool, not
exactly,
because they thought they were gonna make some cyber bucks with it. So on the GPUs, I remember back when I first started, back when I was a kid, we used to generate these bitcoins on our CPUs. It's just something else that's just like completely untouchable. What I can see right now, the only strategy for getting a large botnet, which was one of my initial concerns, was that some of these botnet operators would just start mining on a botnet of 10,000 machines and just start, hoarding all the bitcoins. If they're not able to do that, then I guess maybe their only strategy is to hack into the NVIDIA corporate computers and get the email addresses and access information for all their registered customers and try to hack their systems so they can install their botnets only on machines running NVIDIA cards. So,
well, what I'm waiting for is to have NVIDIA or ATI design their own Bitcoin cards. I mean, might happen in a couple months, couple years. Maybe they will create specific hardware with Bitcoin support. So that would be a really confirmation of Bitcoin's popularity.
Wow, that's fascinating. That's an interesting idea. Great. Okay, I think we pretty much topped off this hour. Anything you want to go over real quick before we take off here?
No, that's it. Thanks for having me, and I enjoyed the other podcast. I still have a couple to catch up with, but it's great. I keep on going.
All right. Well, yeah, thank you. We're having a blast, and the guests like you and all the other people, it's been wonderful just to get on here and throw this stuff around and brainstorm and, and think about it. It's stimulating to have this stuff going on. There's so many things happening right now at a faster pace than most have imagined. I thought it was going to be another 5-10 years before stuff that is happening right now is actually taking place. So it's a really great time. And this show was a lot of fun. This has been quite interesting, and I'm sure that it's going to help somebody. I know it's going to help me in my shopping cart, quote-unquote, systems for doing exchanges in and out between individuals automated in our API and our code. So thanks again, Mids, and I hope to have you back soon to talk about some other topics.
Sure. Cool. Take care.
Yep. See ya. All right, everyone. Thanks a lot for listening again to Cypherpunked, and we'll be back again next week with day after day of great guests and interesting topics. We're going to close out here with Daft Punk Solar Sailor, remixed by Pretty Lights from the last Tron movie.
dodge this.
This is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. AgoristRadio.com is sponsored by MetroPipe.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
Broadcasting from deep within the Second Realm, you are listening to AgoristRadio.com.